Let's hear now about a battle in California between environmentalists and one of the state's largest commercial shellfish operations. The outcome of this is in the hands of the U.S. Supreme Court. Here's the situation. A controversial oyster company sits on a marine wilderness on federal land in Marin County. Its lease has expired, and the company hopes the high court will allow the oyster farm to stay open. It's a divisive issue among residents in western Marin County, as NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Drive just an hour and a half north of San Francisco into Drake's Estero, or estuary, named for the first English explorer to lay claim to California. You're in a near pristine and wind-whipped marine wilderness. It's a federally protected home for large beds of eelgrass, the base of the marine food chain. The Estero hosts the largest colony of harbor seals on the West Coast and tens of thousands of resident and migratory birds. It's also home to the Drake's Bay Oyster Company, where workers are sorting out recently harvested oysters on a crude conveyor belt.
What we do at the conveyor, we're sorting for size and quality.
Kevin Lunny owns Drake's Bay Oyster Company, which plants and harvests about 8 million oysters a year, worth an estimated $1.5 million. He employs 30 people. These oysters are a popular delicacy in nearby restaurants and farmers markets.
Oysters are really one of the best protein food choices we can make.
When Lunny bought this operation back in 2004, the company had only 8 years left on a 40-year federal lease, and the National Park Service told him it wouldn't renew that lease. Fast forward to November 2012, when then-Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar ordered Lunny to wrap up operations within 90 days. But with the pro bono help of libertarian legal groups, Lunny sued the federal government, arguing that Salazar abused his power.
It's a renewable permit. To renew the permit changes absolutely nothing. It sets no precedent at all because we're already here. In a wilderness area, we've already been permitted to be here, and it's simply a renewal.
But some local and national environmental groups have pushed back, saying it's time for Lunny and the Drake's Bay Oyster Company to leave. They say a deal is a deal.
This is a landlord-tenant situation, and the landlord gave them 7 years' notice to say, okay, we're going to want our property back now. It's time that we get it back.
Amy Trainer is the executive director of the West Marin Environmental Action Committee. She says there are hundreds, if not thousands, of federal leases on public lands across the country. She says allowing the oyster farm to remain operating sets a bad precedent.
I really fear it would embolden other leaseholders in our national park system, our forest service areas, and our wilderness areas to fight simply because they don't like the contract.
But not all environmentalists oppose the oyster farm. And some advocates of local sustainable food, such as celebrated chef Alice Waters, have come to Lunny's defense. As you drive to and through Point Reyes Station, the small town near the oyster farm, you'll see lots of blue and white signs that read, Save Our Drake's Bay Oyster Farm. There's one hanging over Sean Bracken's auto repair shop.
And there's no reason why anybody should be put out of business when they're actually doing something that's natural with the area out there and growing oysters. And I don't think it affects the seals. I don't think it affects the eco or anything. And that's why I put the sign up over the door.
And Bracken says he's had only one customer complain about the sign. The controversy has all but exhausted the community, says Tom Beatty, a retired businessman who's against the oyster farm staying in business.
It started out where it would just sort of get in the way of dinner parties, and now it's has been going on for years. There are people in town that don't speak to each other anymore, but I'm hoping that as a community that there can be some sort of healing.
But before that's ever likely to happen, the Drake's Bay Oyster Farm awaits word from the U.S. Supreme Court. After losing 2 rounds in lower courts, the farm operators hope the high court will hear their appeal. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News.
You know, if you actually read the labels on food you eat, you'll find some curious things. David Kestenbaum of our Planet Money team recently found himself staring at a pack of M&Ms, and he saw one number in particular that seemed odd.
I'd gone down to the lobby of our building here to buy a snack, and I couldn't decide which kind of M&M to get, so I bought 2 packs. One regular M&M, one peanut butter-filled M&M. In the elevator back up to the office, I found myself reading the packaging. And I noticed this strange thing. Here, I have one. A pack of original M&Ms weighs 1.69 ounces. The peanut butter ones, slightly less, 1.63 ounces. They were the same price, a dollar each, but you get slightly less of the peanut butter M&Ms. 0.06 ounces less. It's a tiny difference, way down at the third decimal place. I wanted to know why, so I reached out to Mars, the company that makes M&Ms, and while I was waiting to hear back, I made some other calls, and I discovered this whole weird world.
You should appreciate, actually, that the confectionery industry is incredibly secretive.
This is Bill Edwards. He used to work for one of Mars' big rivals, a company called Roundtrees that makes a British candy called Smarties that are very similar to M&Ms.
I mean, more secrets have escaped from the places where they make nuclear weapons than have ever escaped from the places from the major confectionery firms.
Edwards spent a lot of time reverse engineering his competitors' products. And he had a theory here. Maybe, he said, peanut butter M&Ms are more expensive to make, so they put fewer in the package as a way to keep the profit margin the same.
You're not going to do wonders for your business if you bring out a new product that is less profitable than your existing ones.
Oh, so like if you had M&Ms that were out there, there's a certain profit margin, you're going to introduce peanut butter M&Ms. You would never want to introduce that where you're going to make less money on each pack.
No, no.
But then having proposed this beautiful theory, he basically ruled it out. Peanut butter, he says, is actually less expensive. So if anything, he'd expect you to get more in a peanut butter M&M package. So much for the economic explanation. Maybe there was a scientific one.
Is it okay if I buy a lot of M&Ms?
I went back down to the little store in the lobby, and I bought what scientists would call a statistically significant sample size.
10 of these. Should be 10 of these.
I took the M&Ms up to Columbia University, to a guy who had a really, really precise scale. Sanat Kumar, he's chair of the chemical engineering department.
Yeah, this is a tenth of a gram, and this is going to a tenth of a milligram. So 1,000 times smaller than what you're looking for.
This is 1,000 times more accurate than we need.
That's right. Talk about a little bit of an overkill, right? So let's zero that.
Sanat had a different theory. Maybe, he said, each bag gets filled by a machine that drops a precise number of M&Ms in each bag. If the peanut butter ones were just a little bit lighter, that could explain why the package came out lighter. So we started counting.
10, 12, 14, 16, 18.
One bag 20. Had 28, another had 26.
Okay, so 27, 28. So they're not keeping the number constant.
It's all over the map. This is truly amazing. I have no idea what they're doing.
Another beautiful theory destroyed by data. We did discover something weird, though. Something that somehow I'd never realized when I was eating these things. The peanut butter M&Ms and the regular M&Ms are like totally different species. The original chocolate M&Ms are these small, very precise candies with precise weights. The peanut butter M&Ms, by comparison, are monsters. They're larger, they're lumpier, and more irregular. As Sanat puts it, the weights had a larger standard deviation. We measured with the fancy scale.
1.62... 2.0. Fluctuation is amazing.
The larger size turns out to be key to the whole puzzle. I got an email back from the Mars company declining our interview request, but including a statement which explained that for health and nutrition reasons, all Mars products are designed to be 250 calories or less per person. Calories. We did the math. It turns out because the peanut butter-filled ones are so big, if you add just one more of them to these little packages, it would push the calorie count over 250. That, it seems, is why the package weighs a little less. Nothing to do with the price of peanuts compared to cocoa or with the machine that fills the little bags. Calories. I sent a follow-up email asking why the peanut butter M&Ms were so much larger. I got back a one-sentence response. Quote, because of proprietary reasons, we are unable to elaborate on the size of peanut butter M&Ms. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
It's peanut butter jelly time! Peanut butter jelly time! Peanut butter jelly time!
Imagine if a gallon of milk went for $3 where you live, but an hour's drive away, it would cost you $100. Well, something similar is happening right now in California with water used for irrigation. Because of the drought, some farmers are paying 100 times more for water than others. It's provoking debate about whether water in California should move more freely and be sold to the highest bidder. NPR's Dan Charles has the story.
The Bible says rain falls on the just and unjust alike. But in California's vineyards, orchards, and vegetable fields, rain really doesn't fall much at all. Most of the water comes from far away, from melting snow in the mountains. Dams capture it, pumps and canals distribute it, and courts decide who gets to use it. In the end, there are water haves and have-nots. Let's start with one of the haves, Alan Peterson, who grows almonds near the city of Turlock, California. A concrete-lined canal full of water runs right past those orchards.
This water is coming from Lake Don Pedro out of the Tuolumne River.
The Turlock Irrigation District started building dams on the Tuolumne more than a century ago. Now, every farm in the district gets a share of the lake's water. This year, it's less than usual, but still enough to grow a crop of almonds. That secure source of water is as much a part of Peterson's farm as the land. It's a family legacy.
My grandfather, people before him even, you know, built this irrigation system. We came here 100 years ago, and he worked on scraping canals, building this thing up. They sacrificed a lot to have this irrigation system here, and our land prices have reflected that ever since.
The land is expensive, but he gets his water pretty cheaply. Peterson is paying the district just under $30 this year for each acre foot of water. That's enough water to cover an acre of land with a foot of water. But there are farmers on the other side of California's Central Valley this year who are paying much, much more. Sarah Wolf, a farmer and water consultant here, helped arrange some of those deals.
We've had water that has sold upwards of $2,000 an acre foot.
More than $2,000?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was, it's horrible.
Wolf and I are standing in an almond orchard that's alive thanks to that expensive water. It's southwest of Fresno, part of the Westlands Water District. Westlands came late to the California Water Party. It tapped into the statewide water system just 50 years ago. And when there's not enough water for everybody, like this year, farmers here are the first to get cut off. Just to save his orchard, this farmer went looking for farmers outside Westlands who were willing to sell some of their water.
His first demand had to be get enough water to keep the trees alive. And to some degree, I'll pay any price to do it.
Once they agreed on a price, the actual transfer of water was just a matter of aquatic bookkeeping. The seller gave up the right to draw some water from the state's aqueducts, and instead, this farmer was able to. But this kind of exchange does not happen very often. In some places, it's banned. The Turlock Irrigation District, for instance, does not allow farmers to sell any of their $30 water outside the district. So that's why farmers are paying such wildly different prices. The water's not allowed to move freely from one place to another. Economist Richard Howitt at the University of California, Davis, says that's really unfortunate. Irrigation water should be allowed to flow to the places where it's needed most, he says.
It should be good for both producers and consumers to have more efficient use of our basic natural resource.
There are some physical barriers to moving the water around. Very few aqueducts and rivers run between water-rich areas like Turlock and thirsty areas to the west. But Howitt says that problem could be solved.
With small engineering changes, we could move the water from the east to the west and move it from the $20 region to the $2,000 region.
But it's harder to overcome the emotional and political barriers, he says. For example, Alan Peterson, the farmer in Turlock, says people just don't want to sell something that's so central to the life of farming communities.
If we sold our water off, the jobs would go away here too. There would be less commerce going on in our county.
Also, farmers don't want to raise any questions about their legal rights to water. Here's Richard Howitt, the economist.
They are worried that if they sold water, they would be admitting that, quote unquote, they didn't need it.
And others might try to claim it. Environmentalists, for instance, would like to keep more water in California's rivers and wetlands. Sarah Wolf, the farmer and water consultant, says that's why farmers who do sell water sometimes won't admit it.
People are afraid. Yeah, I think there's definitely a hush-hush. I don't want to talk about it. They may take my water away. And I don't blame them for that.
She says if California's water-rich farmers weren't worrying that somebody might take their water, they might actually be more willing to sell it. And everybody would benefit. Dan Charles, NPR News.
If you lucked into a free donut this morning, you already know what I'm going to say. It's donut day. Chains including Krispy Kreme and Dunkin' Donuts were offering freebies and special deals. But a coalition of environmental activists is using the buzz about donuts to call attention to the connection between the fried dough, palm oil, and deforestation. NPR's Allison Aubrey explains.
Like a lot of us, Glenn Hurwitz knows a good donut. We met up at a Krispy Kreme in Washington, D.C.
We've got chocolate iced custard filled, brownie batter, and there's the original glaze, the famous one. But I actually have not eaten a donut in 3 years.
That's when he pieced together how America's love of donuts could destroy forests halfway around the globe. He chairs a rainforest campaign called Forest Heroes, and he explains the big donut chains, including Dunkin' Donuts, Krispy Kreme, and Tim Hortons, fry their donuts in palm oil, or blends of oil that include palm. And the production of this oil on plantations in Southeast Asia has led to massive clear-cutting of forests and labor abuses, where workers do dangerous jobs for little pay.
I just got back from Indonesia a couple weeks ago, and I drove for hours through palm oil plantations. You don't see any other kind of vegetation on what was, until recently, a thriving tropical rainforest teeming with orangutans and tigers and elephants.
To be fair, palm oil is not the only industry contributing to the loss of rainforests. But as its role has come to light, there's been a huge push from environmentalists to get the big multinational companies involved in palm oil to make changes. Hurwitz says the big breakthrough has been new commitments to source oil from suppliers who are not cutting down forests or destroying carbon-rich peatland.
We've seen Kellogg's, Mars, Hershey's, Safeway all take steps to eliminate deforestation from their supply chains. But the donut industrial complex is lagging behind.
I reached out to the three major donut retailers, all of whom declined interviews. But in emails, they told us they are actively working on the issue. And all three say their goal is to purchase all of their palm oil from sustainable sources. Krispy Kreme pointed us to an industry-supported group called the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil that certifies producers who have adopted more responsible practices.
Palm oil growers are making very, very positive changes.
That's the Roundtable's Danielle Morley. She says until a decade ago, there was no agreed-upon system to certify deforestation-free palm oil. Now about 16% of the global supply is certified. Many environmentalists say this is a start, but they argue the certification criteria could be tougher and that more companies using palm oil need to commit to change. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.